This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. Our guest this episode is Patrick Smith, airline pilot, traveler, blogger, news commentator, and author of Cockpit Confidential. Patrick is filled with enthusiasm and lots of informed opinions. In the news, we talk about Farnborough 2016, Airbus, Boeing, and the F-35B. Also, the FAA authorization extension in third-class medical reform, and the Boeing B-29 Superfortress, known as DOC. All that and more, coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 410 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me are a collection of co-hosts. Now, I'll warn you right now, we're having really severe Skype problems this evening, so we're all going to sound a little bit different, but we've finally got everyone connected and we're just going to soldier through it. So we'll start off by introducing Rob Mark. He's the publisher of the Jetwine blog. He's an aviation journalist, pilot, flight instructor. Rob, how are you?
Well, I was never a soldier. I was actually an airman, if we wanted to be specific. But good evening to everyone. Glad we're back and working.
Yeah, finally. Also with us is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Hey, Max.
Hey, nice to be in the studio with you here tonight, or at least the virtual studio. It seems like the internet is trying to divide us rather than unite us tonight.
But it sure is. It's been pretty successful.
It's always fun to be together. I just love this time every week.
And we're also joined by our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof. Hi, David.
This will teach me never to show up early.
Yeah, this is the one time David shows up early, and it kind of
backfired.
Yeah. Our guest this episode is Patrick Smith. Patrick's an active airline pilot. He's also an air travel blogger and an author. He writes the AskThePilot.com website. He's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. Now, Patrick's appeared on, well, really hundreds of radio and television outlets, including PBS, Discovery Channel, CNN, the BBC,
The Beeb,
and National Public Radio. His work's regularly cited in print publications worldwide. He was actually voted one of the 25 best bloggers in 2013 by Time Magazine. So, Patrick, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
You know, that was a pretty big buildup, and I think people are going to be pretty disappointed once I actually start talking. So maybe you should just keep describing me, and I'll just shut up and listen.
There's a lot more to describe. We'll have some of that in the show notes, of course. Patrick, you actually started flying at a very, very early age. Started in the airline business, what, in 1990?
Yeah, you know, I started taking lessons when I was, I don't even remember, 14, 15, had my license when I was 17, instructed for a number of years, still going through a lot of counseling to help me pull through from that experience. Eventually went to work at a regional in 1990, worked my way up three, four, five different airlines before I finally signed on with one of the big carriers, which I've been doing that since 2001 or so. So it's been a long, slow process, and my resume is probably about 18 pages long, but I guess that's not uncommon for a lot of airline pilots. It's stop and go. You know, we deal with furloughs and bankruptcies and mergers, and it can be a painful process.
It's always something in the commercial aviation industry, for sure. Patrick also does a lot of traveling just on his own, is distinct from his job. And Patrick has a lot of interesting things to say about air travel in that experience. And so we're going to be talking with Patrick about those coming up. First, though, we better get started with the aviation news before we all lose the Skype connection again. And so is everyone ready?
Yep. Ready.
Ready from the West.
All right, well, we'll start off talking about Farnborough 2016, just completed. Now, as you probably know, Brian and Micah were over there, and we're going to be hearing some reports from them. Brian and Micah did send along a couple of brief recordings at the start, so why don't we just quickly listen to those? Here's Brian and Micah.
Hi, Max and team. Finally landed here at Heathrow and met up with Micah, and we're ready for an exciting week at Farnborough.
It's already been an amazing experience and a wonderful trip, courtesy of United Airlines. We'll go into more detail about that perhaps in another piece later.
Yeah, Micah, you had a bit of an issue, and I had an interesting flight over as well, and I have a photo to prove it. Hopefully Max can share it in the show notes.
And I guess what actually will need to be said, because people may be implying that the United experience was terrible. On the ground, some communication issues were terrible. In the air, I had the most amazing, wonderful service I could have possibly asked for, unlike anything, Brian, you've ever talked about, so I don't know what you're complaining about.
Yeah, my service was good. It just had more to do with seat pitch than anything else. But we're not here to talk about United. We're here to talk about our upcoming week of the show at Farnborough.
Yes, and we've already been met by Neville Bounds, who was kind enough to come and pick us up. Neville Bounds is a regular listener to the Airplane Geeks, but also a member of the Airline Pilot Guy community. He met us, picked us up. We're sitting down having a quick cup of coffee. He just went to get another one, so we're not going to have the interview with him, but we do need to thank him for coming and helping us and hosting us for so long.
Yeah, and speaking of the Airline Pilot Guy, we're looking forward to meeting Captain Jeff and team for their meetup that they're going to have, and hopefully we'll be able to participate in the live broadcast that they're doing, and a whole bunch of other fun and excitement coming up. So look forward to getting those reports.
Yes, and just to mention other upcoming things as part of that we should say is, yes, we're going to be meeting Captain Jeff and Dr. Steph and Captain Nick from Airline Pilot Guy, but also Carlos Stebbings and Matt Smith from Plane Talking UK, a podcast that came about from the Airplane Geeks.
That's really cool. Looking forward to meeting them as well.
Brian, it's going to be a great week. And Max and company and Airplane Geek listeners, we'll get back to you later.
Thanks. Talk to you. Bye.
All right. We were hoping to have Micah join us just briefly. He's sort of stuck in an airport someplace trying to recover from some canceled flights. So we probably won't have Micah with us this episode on that. But we do have another really brief recording from the guys.
Hi, this is Brian and Micah again. We just checked into the wonderful Holiday Inn here at Farnborough. I don't think we could get a better location, and looking forward to the show tomorrow.
Did you see we are just a 10-minute walk from the air show entrance? We don't have to take a cab. We are right there. We can get up, and it's in our backyard.
Or it's a 5-minute European walk.
Well, it's a 5-minute European walk and a 20-minute Micah walk.
Yeah, there you go. So, Micah, since it is such a short walk over there, what are you looking forward to seeing tomorrow?
Well, you know what amazes me is that here we are, we said in the UK, we're in Great Britain, we're not quite on the continent, and who knows what's happening with Great Britain and the rest of Europe, but nonetheless, we're going to be able to see some European aircraft that we might never get a chance to see on display or to fly in the U.S. I've been looking forward to seeing the Red Arrows. Sure, we've seen the Thunderbirds, and we've seen the Blue Angels, but here are the Red Arrows, the British demonstration team, flying in their own home turf.
Yeah, I've never seen them fly, so definitely looking forward to that.
And the other thing that there's going to be huge Airbus displays, the A350 is going to be here, and the A350 is going to be flying. I've never seen an A350 before.
Yep, me neither. I've never been on an A380 nor an A350, so definitely looking forward to that. And I think something that might make David happy is there's going to be some Russian military hardware here, so that'll be good to see.
A lot of Russian helicopters, and the A400M, I believe, is going to be flying as well, and the Eurofighter.
Yeah, haven't seen that either. So lots of new stuff for me.
Never seen a Eurofighter before. And the other thing that I've never seen before is an aircraft go into reheater. We're in the UK. We need to say reheater and not afterburner. So I'm hoping that we can catch a Eurofighter going into the reheaters. And I believe there's also going to be an F-35B, getting back to some American product, that will be doing some vertical takeoff and landings.
That'll be really cool to see. I've seen the Harrier, but of course never seen the F-35. So definitely some excitement there.
I think it's going to be a wonderful experience, and I can't wait to have that. See what unfolds.
Yeah, see what Farnborough has to bring. Micah, so looking forward to seeing the show with you.
Looking forward to being here with you, Brian.
All right, thanks, guys. We'll be hearing a lot more from them coming up in the not-too-distant future. But there were some interesting news items to come out of the event. One is Airbus and the A380 production rate. And we see in ATW Online, they reported that Airbus has announced that starting in 2018, they're going to drop the monthly production rate from 2.5 A380s a month down to...
One a month.
Down to one a month.
1.25.
So some people are playing this as if the A380 is done for. I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I don't know, Patrick, do you have any thoughts on the kind of the future outlook for the A380?
Well, orders for any model tend to be really cyclical. I know Emirates has been lobbying Airbus to build a bigger A380 with the promise that if they build a bigger one and re-engine it, they'll buy over 200 of them. And Airbus says, well, even with a promise like that, that's not enough for them to go and get started on a project that expensive. I don't think they've broken even yet on the existing A380. So coming up with a bigger, more expensive derivative is something they're going to be really cautious about.
Yeah, and where are they going to park all those A380s? I mean, I'm not sure there are enough gates around the world to accommodate that many more.
Have any of you guys been through Dubai? It's a pretty incredible scene if you're there at 2 or 3 in the morning when Emirates has their big rush. And last time I was through there, we counted, it was close to 100 777s and probably 30 or 40 380s all lined up at the concourse, maybe even more. It was like something from a fantasy. I mean, you almost couldn't believe it. It looked so futuristic and so crazy. Just the hazy sky and the orange lights and then all these tails of these giant airliners. It was incredible.
Yeah, quite a sight.
I've been on numerous A380s. I've flown Emirates, Qatar, Asiana, who else? Somebody else. You know, I think Emirates has probably the best product, and I recently flew the A350 from Doha to Boston on Qatar's new service, and you know that was kind of neat. Nothing really radical about the experience. The one thing that jumps out at you on the A350 is there are no overhead bins in the center section. There are only bins on the aisles. And then the center is clear all the way back.
Huh.
And it gives the airplane a perception of being bigger and wider than it actually is. Not that it's small. It's A330/777 size-ish. But without that center section, without the center section bins, it just feels a lot more open. And there's a neat little kind of entryway alcove, like a little lobby where you first come into the plane. And other little accoutrements like that. And the cabin sculpting, similar to the 787, is very organic. Lots of curves and roundishness that I think is a more pleasant aesthetic for passengers.
I heard a tone. I don't know what that was.
I don't either.
I think that was telling me to shut up.
Oh, no.
No, I think that's my phone.
I think it is your phone.
Unfortunately, that's an alert.
Okay.
An email alert, and I'm in the process of trying to shut them off.
Okay.
Well, let's not forget that the A350 that we see today is not the A350 that was going to eventually come to be when Airbus first announced it. They were going to kind of gloss over the A330 and make a few upgrades here and there, and customers said, not on your life. and Airbus had to go back to the drawing boards and really redesign the A350 almost from the ground up. But it they had it up at Airbus. I'm sorry, they had it at AirVenture last year, and even at full power when he came by, it's an incredibly quiet airplane, at least from the outside.
Yeah, it is.
And on the inside, the A380 and A350 both are surprisingly quiet on the inside. The 787 as well, but it's more noticeable, at least to me, on the Airbuses. I've been in the A380 behind the wing, and even on takeoff, you don't feel and hear that blast that you do in a normal airplane. It's more of a subtle rumble. You hear the plates shaking in the galley. And that's about it. And then once you're in the air, it's very quiet. So the A380 in particular, I mean, it's a ghastly, hideous airplane on the outside. There can't be an uglier jetliner.
Okay.
In the annals of aviation history, it is the ugliest plane ever built. But on the inside, I have to say, it's pretty neat.
I love this man. He says Qatar, and he hates A380s. This is good.
And, you know, behind all of this, Airbus this, Airbus that, you know, poor Boeing, the 747, you know, arguably the most iconic jetliner of all time is, you know, in its, I guess, last gasps. I mean, it's just a matter of time before they close production down. And that, to me, is really sad because, you know, the A380 technical marvel that it is, it just has absolutely none of the 747's grace, none of its elegance. There's an essay in my book where I kind of go on at length about this.
I was going to bring that up.
The Empire State Building. The A380 is, the 747 is the Empire State Building of airplanes. It's no longer the biggest, it's no longer the flashiest, but it's still the classiest and the most elegant. And, you know, the A380, by contrast, is one of those, you know, glitzy, flashy glass towers like you'd see in Dubai. And you know, that to me is too bad.
Didn't you make a reference to beluga whales when you described the A380?
How does it not look like a beluga whale?
That forehead, right?
It's the forehead. It's the way they placed the cockpit kind of somewhere between the main deck and the upper deck, and not committing to one or the other gives the plane that just kind of, I don't know, there's so many different ways to describe it, but beluga is. And it's a very self-conscious looking plane. It's very big, but it's trying not to look big. It's almost kind of scrunching in on itself. It reminds me of one of those big, ugly cruise ships that you see nowadays that are just so top-heavy and awkward and clumsy looking versus an old classic ocean liner like the QE2 or the Queen Mary.
Right.
Again, you know, the 380 is the ugly, garish cruise liner, and the 747 is the classic ocean liner.
Yeah, that's true. It's interesting how certain design aspects of an airplane can, you know, evoke different emotions about you know, the craft.
Not that there aren't some good-looking planes, newer good-looking planes. I'm undecided on the 787. I can't decide if I like it or hate it, but at least it's distinctive. The nose, I think, is cool. The tail is a little too, I don't know, anthropomorphic or something. It looks like a fish, but it's distinguished. I mean, you see it, you know what it is. Distinguishable. It's got a little personality to it, which is something you can't say about, I don't know, the A320. You know, the 777, of course, is a great looking plane, especially the 300. So there are some good designs out there, but it's not like it used to be when I was a kid. You know, there was a 727, a DC-10, an L-1011, a 707, and you could tell one from the other at just the quickest glimpse. I mean, you know, a plane on a 10-mile final, you could tell immediately what it was. And planes were so distinctive, and each plane had its own individual profile. And that's gone. I mean, planes are so generic now and so all like each other. Especially when you get into the regional jets now, there are so many, and there are new ones coming on the market from Russia and from China and from Japan, and they all look exactly the same.
Yeah, same with cars. I mean, you remember back in the, you know, 70s or 60s, and they were, you know, of course, you know, the other thing is there were more companies making all of these things, you know, more automotive companies, more companies building airliners. We had, what, Lockheed, the L-1011s. We had McDonnell Douglas. And, you know, maybe this sameness has to do with just having fewer manufacturers.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess I hadn't thought of that. And you had Convair, and the Brits were making planes and so on.
Well, let's talk about Boeing just a little bit. There's a lot of press reports describing how Boeing lost the race in this air show, this event. Airbus gathered a larger number of orders than Boeing. To me, it's always interesting how the important metric in a lot of people's minds seems to be the number of aircraft sold, the number of aircraft announced at Farnborough or Paris or that kind of a thing. I'm not sure that that's an entirely relevant metric. I mean, it plays good in the press, and everybody likes to have lots of orders that they can announce at the show. But I don't know. Do you guys think that that's really that important in the long run?
Well, eventually orders kind of trickles down to shipments, and I know that's really what counts. And maybe orders seems big in people's mind because from a consumer standpoint, you know, when you buy something, it ships immediately and the sale is made. Holy cow, you know, you buy an airliner. When does it ship? You know, 5, 10 years later? You know, they're not actually, you know, getting the money until pretty far down the stream, and a lot can happen between the time an order places and the time it may or may not actually be shipped.
And are we talking about the number of aircraft sold or the value of the aircraft sold overall? Do 4 A320s equate to 1 777? I don't know. How do you look at it? Again, there are different metrics.
You could even look at it from a passenger standpoint, right? How many seats are each of the airframers selling, or revenue miles? Or I mean, there's a lot of different metrics to describe who's got a bigger share of the market than the other. But it just seems to me that when you've got thousands and thousands of airplanes in the backlog, for one thing, you're not going to get many new orders anyway, because you know the production is pretty well subscribed at this point. And with backlogs like that, incremental orders doesn't seem to be the measure of success for a company to me.
I think Boeing, Airbus, things will even out over time.
Yeah.
More or less.
And the thing that struck me was not the split between the two, but the huge drop from this time last year. Mm-hmm. So the total number of orders was down significantly. I don't remember the numbers, but it was like, less than half of what was booked last year. And I've been wondering for a while now, are the airlines, they have so much stuff on order. Do they need less than they did a year ago? Are we starting to reach a peak in terms of airline production? And I would be willing to bet that we might be getting close to the top on that for this cycle.
It's pretty saturated.
Yeah, you look at the back orders for, you know, the 787, the A350. I mean, there are a lot of big planes to be delivered over a long span of time. And, you know, that's playing a role.
Right. I just mentioned an article in CNN by Tom Patterson, who I actually met at the last Aviation Geek Fest in Seattle. And he published 5 wow moments at the world's greatest air show. And his list of 5 is kind of interesting. We'll have a link to this in the show notes. But they include the Airbus A380 flying display, the Eurofighter Typhoon, the Antonov AN-178, the Airbus A350 XWB, and also the Lockheed Martin F-35B, which did fly at the air show, David. And I think it was kind of an impressive show. The reaction seems to be pretty good.
I think the reaction was, it's noisy.
Yes.
Which seemed to be a common theme every time it flew. But It's a positive thing for Great Britain because they're one of the leading purchasers of the B, the vertical takeoff and landing one. So, and they've been, and Great Britain has been without Harriers now for quite a few years. So it's good to see something vertical takeoff and landing over in the UK. And it was a really cool flyover that the Brits did with the Red Arrows, 2 Eurofighters, 2 Typhoons and an F-35B all in formation. So that was a highlight from this side of the pond as far as I was concerned.
Now, we have a nice video. This was from Airboyd on YouTube. They actually have a pretty good YouTube channel. But it's a video of the F-35 flight, and it's got some pretty good visuals, but it's also got great audio, including the announcer, who you can hear pretty clearly describe the various aspects of the F-35 as it makes its flights at the Farnborough Air Show. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Oh, and the Tom Patterson had just some lovely writing in here as he was talking about the flyby of the Lockheed Martin F-35B. He said, "Wait, a flyby? Calling this a flyby would be like calling the Mona Lisa a lovely painting," which I thought was a very nice simile. I mean, I love great writing, and this was just a very nice simile to put into the story.
Yeah.
Okay, air shows. Let's see. You've got Farnborough, Paris, the big one, Singapore, Dubai. Which ones am I missing?
Those are the big ones.
What I'm getting at is, why are there no big air shows in North America? Why don't we have one? Why is there not a U.S.?
What would you call Oshkosh's Sun and Fun?
I mean, something more oriented more towards the commercial end.
Why? That would be a colossal waste of time.
No, David, stop that.
Yeah, I have to agree with David. I don't see the point. I mean, there are so many outside the United States. Can't we not be special for something? I mean, AirVenture is the largest air show in the U.S., but then, of course, as you said, it may not take too many other air shows to beat them. But we've got commercials. We don't. What do we need with another one for?
Well, it's an interesting point, I guess. Maybe some of our listeners have some thoughts on that. But yeah, in terms of something that's oriented towards the business of aviation, I mean, I know Oshkosh has components of that. Oshkosh has a lot of things that Farnborough and Paris and all the others don't have, but those others have a lot of business transactions.
Well, we do have the NBAA show. The National Business Aviation Show runs between either Orlando this year and Vegas the opposite year, and they have 30,000 people at that, which for that segment, business aviation, that's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well.
And there is the National Air Show in Ohio. Dayton is a civilian and military air show.
Is so it Cleveland in Ohio?
I mean, Cleveland, yeah. Cleveland is the international, yeah. So, I mean, why? You know, and the other thing about
these, all of these are GA or more business aviation oriented. I guess I'm throwing in my airline bias here. Just I'd like to see something in line with Paris.
Why? But why?
Because it's cool, and then we've got Boeing right here in the U.S. And
well, we've got Airbus now here in the U.S. too.
We fancy ourselves the aviation leaders, the global aviation leaders, commercially as well as in these other respects. So you know, why can't we have an air show? Damn it!
Well, we do. We've got several hundred of them scattered throughout the country.
Yeah, but
well, they do in other they do in Europe too. But they also have the big prizes, the Farnborough and the Paris. And okay, we have the Oshkosh, but that's kind of a different concept.
Yeah, I think it really is a different concept because, I mean, you could argue that Paris and Farnborough and the others, they're only peripherally an air show. What they really are is a business show. It's the business of generally commercial aviation.
They're a convention.
In some respects, I'm making a political comment here. Maybe I shouldn't be making.
No, that's
fine. Behind all of this, you know, I feel like we're falling behind. I mean, our airports don't stack up to the rest of the world. Is it just a matter of time before, you know, our whole aviation culture just kind of slips behind the rest of the world? I don't know.
Yeah, interesting to think about.
Our airports aren't as good. Our airlines aren't as good. You know, what's next?
Yeah. All right. Well, just as long as we don't say, let's make America great again, in which case that'll really send us down the rabbit hole.
I am not going to say that.
We're not going to go there. All right. Well, we're going to be hearing more about the air show from Brian and Micah in the future. But just a couple of other interesting things that happened in the news. Maybe a major one is that the FAA's authorization extension was passed by the U.S. House and Senate. And President Barack Obama signed it into law on July 15. And what this does is it extends it through September 2017, but includes some significant things. Third-class medical reform is now in there and permanent, which Max Trescott, we've been talking about that quite a lot. And I guess it was sort of expected that this would be part of the continuing authorization.
Yeah, it's fascinating. There have been so many attempts at getting a third-class medical reform passed that it's almost as if every bill that goes through has this attached to it. I know just in the last month, I believe there were three bills which had it attached. The Senate, I think, has passed it three times. The House finally passed a bill that that had it included. So it's rather interesting. All these have had different variations over time. This one specifically says if you've held a medical any time in the decade prior to July 15th, 2016, that in the future you can follow certain rules and you can fly without a third-class medical. If you're flying an aircraft with up to six seats, less than 6,000 pounds, up to five passengers, there's some things you need to do. You have to take a free online course every 2 years, and you can't fly faster than 2,500 feet or above flight level 180. Also can't operate for compensation or for hire. So I would imagine that, boy, the number of third-class medicals that are being issued is going to drop precipitously. I think a lot of people are going to choose not to do it. So it's also going to sweep people back in who might have, perhaps decided not to go for a medical in the last 1 or 2 years because they were afraid that they wouldn't pass. Because if you have been rejected, for a medical, then you're not covered by this.
Right.
How about some first-class medical reform? I would lobby for that. No, seriously, I think...
What would you like?
I think every 6 months for a first-class medical is a little bit excessive. Unless there's something going on. I think certain people should be allowed to stretch it out to once a year for a first class. That's just me, though, because I resent having to go every 6 months because it's a pain in the neck.
6 months is awfully frequently, yeah.
Yeah, and why not an age cutoff, right? Why not, 1 year for people who are under a certain age?
They already have that for the EKG stipulation, but maybe for the whole thing. I don't know, something to think about.
Hmm. Yeah, well, maybe that'll be the next frontier.
Well, I know the AMEs are not real happy about this, the medical examiners. I mean, I just had mine a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him, so this is probably not going to be good for your business, huh? And he looked at me and said, you think? So he was not a happy camper.
A couple of just real quick news items before we move on. David, the B-29, Doc, the B-29 Super Fortress, had its first flight. And that's very exciting after, 16 years of rebuilding?
Yep. And it, the last time it flew, Eisenhower was president. And we talk about America being great. I mean, we now actually have two B-29s restored and flying. Nobody else in the world has that. I didn't ever think in my lifetime I'd ever see two B-29s. And the fact that they're going to probably eventually be together with a bunch of B-17s, yeah, we've got a really good aviation culture. We may not be, and it was a really good celebration for Boeing 100th. It's not just about airliners for Boeing. If it wasn't for the military component, they wouldn't be building airliners because it all started with the 707, and that was really a tanker for a B-52. So we got to keep our focus on where our culture came from. So I have to disagree slightly with our guest that it's not always about airliners, but this was a big deal. And Fifi actually saw, Doc actually saw combat. Fifi never did. So we now have a combat restored B-29 flying the skies, and good to that team.
Yeah. All right. One last item, and I really, really hesitate to bring this up, but this is making the rounds in the news pretty strongly. Right now, we had an individual who is, I guess, an elected official in the U.S. who made some pretty strong comments about one of the candidates for U.S. president. The aviation twist to this is that individual is also an employee of United Airlines. Do you guys think that is, first of all, do you think that's a news story at all?
Anything involving airlines becomes a news story. Haven't you noticed that?
Anything involving United becomes a news story.
Well, let's be serious. If it wasn't an airline pilot working for a company that we all know, and they said what they did about a certain lady candidate who shall go unnamed, I mean, people would go, yeah, okay, right. And the other guy's a dope too. And it would have gotten no further than that. But the fact that this man's a member of a state legislature and also a pilot for a major airline in the U.S., it's pretty hard to say, do his comments represent his views as a pilot for this airline or his views as a legislator for that particular state? Or is this just somebody just making a general statement? And when you add all of those other things in there, it kind of changes a little bit, I think.
Well, he's
a public figure. I mean, that's the thing, right? If you're a state legislator, you're a public figure, and you're kind of held to a slightly higher standard in terms of what you're saying. And to call for the death of someone, you know, that's pretty extreme for a public figure.
Yeah, as an elected official, regardless of what his day job is, so to speak, you know, he is entitled to and expected to voice opinions that may or may not be something that his employer, you know, sees in a particular light, which is fine, but that's to a point. And when you start suggesting somebody be killed or executed, you know, even if you mean it as hyperbole and then kind of backtrack on it, that I think that crosses a line.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I make my comment that I made to us all that, you know, officially, if someone is charged with treason, they have two options. They either get hung or shot by firing squad. That's a statement of fact.
Okay.
And nobody has been.
Wait a minute. Where did the treason come in, David?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, he was saying she should be charged with treason and then hung and shot or hung. Correct? Isn't that what the quote was?
Yeah, that's what he said.
I see. Okay.
So if you are charged with treason, I'm not saying I agree with him, but if you were charged with treason in the United States, you are either hung or shot by firing squad.
Convicted of treason.
Convicted of treason.
Right, which wouldn't happen.
Which he is not yet.
So
not yet. Okay.
So we understand.
You know, Max, I have to give you credit. I didn't think you were even going to raise this one.
everything is sort of out of control with this episode that I figured, why not throw that in?
Listen, and let's see what happens. Story trumps any of the other ones.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Boo. Yes.
Again, we're speaking with Patrick Smith. His website is askthepilot.com. The book is Cockpit Confidential. Subtitle is Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. Patrick, one of the things that you talk about in the book is you reference the theater of travel. Tell us what the theater of travel means to you.
Well, what it is the, I call it the grand theater of air travel. And by that, what I mean is my personal passion for aviation, for flying, for what I do for a living, draws in more than just the hands-on, seat-of-the-pants thrill of flying itself. It's more than that. It's the airlines. It's airports. It's the places that the airlines fly to. It's all of that together. That's the grand theater to me. Maybe a better way to explain this is to talk about what got me into flying and into airplanes to begin with. When I was a little kid, I was an airline geek more than I was an airplane geek. I would collect airline timetables and basically anything with an airline logo on it. My friends and I would go to the airport on the weekends and we would just carry boxes with us and just go rummaging through the ticket counters and actually onto airplanes, and we would just take anything we could find that had an airline logo on it. And, you know, instead of doing my homework at night, I would look through timetables, and my favorite, the route map, the airline route map. Remember, timetables used to have those three-panel sections that would fold out and would show the global routes of all the carriers. You know, I could just sit for hours looking at those, and that's what got me into flying. It wasn't just planes or flying. It was places that airlines flew to. And of course, these, you know, great machines that did the flying itself. You know, in my formative years, I guess it was the 747 and the L-1011 and the DC-10 and all these kind of classic jetliners. You know, not that I don't love flying in and of itself. I do. But it's more than that to me. It's the whole business. Does that make sense? I mean, not to over-romanticize it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's interesting how different people are sort of attracted to aviation for different reasons in different ways. And one of the kind of different things about your writing, Patrick, is that I think you're kind of coming at it from a really interesting and really different perspective. I mean, you talk about the difference between the travel and the journey, for example.
And you touched on something at the beginning of this conversation when you mentioned that I do a lot of traveling. You know, I've been to, I don't know, 90 or so countries, and a lot of that traveling has been not on the job, but in my spare time. And where that came from is going back to childhood and studying those airline timetables and those route maps. It was my infatuation with the airlines that got me into studying and being fascinated by other places and cultures. I would never have, you know, gone off and visited all these countries if I hadn't been into airlines and airplanes first. And I feel like the industry introduced me to the world of travel. And you know, I think that's cool. And I wish other people would feel inspired that same way. For a lot of folks, it's the other way around.
Yes. But the approach that you took, I mean, that's something that's still possible today, right? That's not peculiar to the period of time, you know, when it affected your life.
No, not at all. If anything, it's more possible now that you've got, you know, these long haul jetliners that are basically going everywhere all the time. You know, pretty much every two major cities in the world, with some scattered exceptions, are connected now nonstop by, you know, whether it's a 777LR or an A380 or whatever. It's just amazing.
Patrick, the stories that you relate, the questions in the book Cockpit Confidential that you address, these come from the column that you had originally, right?
Yeah, originally I had a column on the website Salon. It was called Ask the Pilot. Not my choice of a title, but that's what they gave me, and no point in changing it now. The column ran for about a decade, and then I brought the brand independent, so to speak, at askthepilot.com, where I do the blog now. And the questions in the book, most of the book is set up in a Q&A format with essays and stories kind of breaking it up. But most of it is Q&A. And the questions are, some of them are verbatim questions that readers sent in over the years. Others are, I guess, composites of questions with, you know, the wording tweaked. But one way or the other, they are all actual questions that I've been asked. Some many more times than others.
And one of the things that I like about how you answer the questions is that you bring some interest to the writing. The style, I think, is very compelling. So, for example, when you're addressing a topic that, let's say, that I or any reader is you know, very familiar with, it almost doesn't matter. You don't tend to skip to the next one because what you had to say about that topic, I find very interesting.
Well, part of that maybe is that I answer questions that I think are interesting questions and that are fun to answer and that I can answer in a compelling way. Not every question, you can't do that with every question. So maybe some were left out because they just would have been crappy, boring answers.
So, the boring questions don't make it in.
I mean, some of the questions are admittedly a little silly, and maybe in some ways I'm, you know, making fun a little bit of the person who asked that question, but it's also a fun and entertaining question to answer.
Are there any questions that are kind of among your favorites or ones that have any kind of, you know, special meaning to you or anything like that?
Well, there are certainly topics that are my favorite, and in some cases at the same time my least favorite to address. And you know, the different, you can take any of those topics and break them up into different questions. You know, questions about cockpit automation, for example. You know, if there's one topic that gets me started, it's explaining to people, you know, the capabilities of cockpit automation, what the autopilot really is, and more to the point, what it is not. Because there's so much bad information out there, so many misconceptions and so many assumptions about what cockpit automation really can do. And just, there's such a mythology around it, and it drives me crazy sometimes. You know, we hear over and over and over again in the media that, you know, planes are so automatic nowadays, they just fly themselves, and pilots are just there as backups, and that's so untrue. I mean, it's not just a little bit untrue. It's completely ridiculous. But it's become repeated to the point where millions of people now believe that airline pilots just sit there and the plane flies itself, which is preposterous, but that's the conventional wisdom. And so when I address that, it gets me going. It's in some ways really fun, and there's a lot to say about it, but it also kind of drives me crazy at the same time.
Are you a proponent of a lot of hand flying the aircraft, quote unquote, to maintain proficiency and sharpness in that area?
Well, the way to answer that is, airline pilots nowadays rely on a somewhat different skill set than we relied on in decades past. But it's in a lot of ways unfair to say that the older skill set was more important than the one today. It's just different. And a certain fluency, a certain level of skill is required in both. And so whatever it takes for you to be you know, up to speed in both aspects. Sure, I switch off the autopilot, switch off the flight director sometimes, and hand fly just to do it. Some of us do that, some of us don't. How important is it to do that? I'm not sure.
We've talked about the fact that the trailer for the movie Sully is out now, and at some point in the not too distant future, we'll be seeing that movie. And I think a lot of folks,
you'll be seeing it.
Yes. folks have different, they're interested in it. A lot of enthusiasts and aviation professionals are nervous maybe that it may be sort of a Hollywood production and not tell a good story or a true type of a story. You've commented on the so-called miracle on the Hudson, I think, saying that it really wasn't a miracle per se, but it was really something a little bit different than that.
Well, let me just say first that I am at the point where I almost cannot watch any Hollywood movie that portrays commercial aviation. I think the Denzel Washington flight movie was the last straw. I saw that movie, couldn't believe how awful it was, then watched it again a year or so later thinking, well, maybe it won't bother me so much the second time, and it was worse. Anyway, yeah, there's a section in chapter 4, I think, in the book where I talk about the quote-unquote miracle on the Hudson. And, you know, not to downplay what Sullenberger and his first officer did, which was nothing easy under the circumstances. At the same time, there was a lot of luck involved. And Sullenberger himself and his co-pilot, Jeffrey Skiles, would be the first to admit that. And when they do so, it just comes across as false modesty. But really, they're telling the truth. If those engines had quit at a slightly different point in that departure, or if it had been dark out, or if the skies had been overcast, almost certainly the result would have been a catastrophe. But because it happened exactly where it did, when it did, they were able to glide into the river, which, you know, for all of its difficulties, well, put it this way, if you took 1,000 airline pilots and put them in that same scenario and said, land on that 15-mile-long water runway, do you think they pretty much all would have done it successfully?
I don't know what the percentage would of success would be.
I mean, it's hard not to say that what they did was easy, but you know, to describe it as a miracle and chalk it all up to skill is not being fair. And you know, they'd be the first to admit that.
Well, it's really there was some good judgment. I mean, not every pilot would think to go for the water. I mean, a large percentage would, but you know, I think people are so conditioned to land at airports. There could be some percentage that would have said, oh, I think I can make Teterboro. And that would have been an absolute disaster. So, I mean, I think it's great that they were, you know, among the significant percentage of pilots that recognized that the one, you know, really, you know, safe place that was not going to endanger the public would be to go for the water, because you're guaranteed that you're going to make it, as opposed to maybe you wouldn't quite make the big airport and then you're going to be rolled up into a ball of aluminum.
It could have been a lot worse. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, what they had to deal with was absolutely an extremely serious emergency. But, you know, the overplay in our culture with the word hero and you know, kind of hyping and super dramatizing these events. I don't know. Maybe if the plane hadn't splashed down in front of the world's media capital, it wouldn't have been the quite the spectacle that it was made out to be.
Interesting.
You know, there's some truth to that. I noticed the treatment of two very different accidents in Mexico of small aircraft that were being used for volunteer medical flights. One of them was on CNN around the world, and you know, it crashed in downtown Ensenada, and there was film of it. And the other one crashed maybe 2 miles offshore. Boom. You know, you didn't see or hear about that crash ever. It was just remarkable what having some film in the can does in terms of publicity.
And in the book, I describe, you know, I say, if you want to describe a pilot as a hero, you know, here are some examples, you know, that were even more harrowing. And I talk about a United flight that landed after a complete electrical failure at an airport in the Andes, or an American Eagle crew that had to deal with a rudder that went berserk, you know, things that were in a lot of ways, you know, more likely to end in a catastrophe than the Sullenberger dual engine failure, but that nobody has ever heard of. And I'm sure there are numerous other examples like that out there that even I don't know about.
Yeah. Patrick, one of the things that we often talk about is the TSA situation, the security at airports. And it's certainly something that air travelers complain about a great deal. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that experience is keeping people from flying because they'd rather avoid that whole experience, or just in general, what are your thoughts on the state of security at airports?
I don't know how many people outright avoid flying because they don't want to deal with security. I know a lot of people say that they do, but I don't know what the actual numbers might be. What I do know is that the experience is just so much worse than it needs to be. And that's too bad, because it makes an already stressful experience just that much more stressful and that much more tedious. You know, where to start? Security is something we could talk about all day. You know, there are a couple of kind of fundamentally wrong things. I mean, the first one, of course, is the idea that we treat every single person who flies as a potential terrorist of equal threat, which, you know, it's a nice idea, but in a system where you have more than 2 million people flying every single day of the week, it's just not a practical or a sustainable approach. There has to be a way to kind of call the herd and realize that certain people are worthy of more scrutiny than others. And then that gets into profiling, which is a dirty word and opens up a whole, you know, can of worms. And I think that the TSA's pre-check program is a step in the right direction. And ultimately, people have to realize, too, that real airport security doesn't take place on the terminal in the concourse. It goes on backstage. It's law enforcement and FBI and it's CIA and TSA and people working backstage to stop plotters and to catch people before they get to the airport. Once a terrorist has made it to the airport, he or she is going to know how to skirt whatever safeguards we have in place. And segue from that is, no matter what we do, we're never going to be 100% safe. Mm. And we need to be okay with that. I mean, air travel has been a target for saboteurs for decades and decades and decades. This didn't all begin on 9/11. You know, go back to the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, when there were bombings and hijackings just all the time. And I think that's lost on a lot of people who either weren't alive then or just don't remember. One of the big and rarely mentioned ironies, which is that none of the security protocols that have been put in place today would have stopped the 9/11 attacks to begin with. Hmm. Like the whole TSA apparatus that we have now seems to all, you know, it exists because of 9/11, yet nothing they're actually doing would have prevented those attacks. And that goes just completely unnoticed. And the success of the attacks had nothing to do with weapons. I mean, what pointy objects the hijackers used, whether it was box cutters or knives, that really was irrelevant. They could have used anything. It wasn't about weapons. It was about the element of surprise and taking advantage of our understanding of what a hijacking was and how it was going to unfold based on the years and years of precedence before that, all the hijackings throughout the decades before that. As long as those guys didn't chicken out, they were guaranteed to succeed. Hmm. And it didn't matter if they had a, you know, a box cutter, a knitting needle, whatever, especially when they were also bluffing about having bombs. It was taking advantage of our mindset. It was about the element of surprise. But our response has been one of just, you know, hyper-focusing on weapons and trying to root out every, you know, conceivable weapon, whether it's a corkscrew or a fork or whatever. And that just, pardon the pun, misses the point.
Yeah, yeah. I think I agree with you in that if there is another attack of that magnitude, it'll probably come from a completely different vector, because why would they, try to circumvent the controls, the security, the processes that we have in place?
And think of all the cumulative time, the immense amounts of time we waste every day going through people's bags to take out, you know, a pair of scissors or a small knife, whatever. Yeah. I mean, as if you couldn't make a sharp, deadly object from almost anything that's on an airplane.
Right.
It's mind-boggling, but it's, you know, we're living with it. And what's really frustrating is that this many years after 9/11, it's just become, you know, what we expect.
Yeah, it's institutionalized.
I used to think in the years right after 9/11, when we were, you know, kind of hysterical about it, that after a certain amount of time, this was going to go away and we'd be back to normal. And it hasn't. It's just what we deal with now. And I don't think it's ever going to change.
Right. On a brighter note, finally, Patrick, do you have any adventures coming up? Any exciting destinations? Any trips planned?
I don't know. Let's see. Last year, my most recent adventures, we did Malta, Mauritius. I have so many places on my list, from Bolivia to Uzbekistan. I don't know. I don't know where my next big trip is going to be.
Well, I'm sure it'll be someplace really interesting. All right. Well, Patrick, we really want to thank you for spending some time with us on the Airplane Geeks. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you online and the book?
Well, the book, as you mentioned, is called Cockpit Confidential, and the best place to get it, I guess, is on Amazon, or you can find it in the bricks and mortar bookstore if you know where there are any still standing. The website is askthepilot.com, and it's a collection of blog posts, essays and stories, and just general rants of my choosing. And you can send me questions, and I try to answer all of my mails. So if you write to me, I will at some point get back to you, as long as you're not asking me about chemtrails.
Yeah. We had a listener, this was some years ago, write to us and demand that we finally address chemtrails and bring the truth out, which, of course, we pretty much ignored that email. We want to thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick. I love the book.
Oh, thanks, man.
It really does have a writing style that I found just really engaging. And, you know, you learn a lot along the way. So,
well, I'm glad you said that, because I put a lot of work into not just the information in the book, but how I presented that information. I tried to be, I don't know, artistic about it. I tried to make it a book that somebody could enjoy, even if they didn't already have a vested interest in aviation.
Mm.
Just make it a fun book to read for anybody.
Yeah, and I think you succeed. Yeah. And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with the airplane of the week.
Thanks, Max. So on May 23rd, I said, quote, next week we'll do the Mirage 3E. Well, life and events have gotten in the way, but 2 months later, 8 episodes later, I'm returning to my promises. The Mirage 3C was successful, but had issues. A multi-role variant was proposed. Again, the airframe grew. A 12-inch plug was inserted into the fuselage. The plug behind the cockpit increased the size of the avionics bay. It also provided more fuel. It also improves the lines, in my humble opinion. The avionics causing the plug was a Marconi continuous wave Doppler radar. This resulted in a dome or bulge below the cockpit on most but not all airframes. The Doppler supported low-level missions by giving terrain-following radar. The other external difference for the 3E was a high-frequency antenna located at the base of the tail. Mirages with this antenna had a crank in the tail instead of a straight diagonal. Other external modifications was the Altar 09 afterburner can. The clamshell open and closing vertically were replaced with pedals, which is the standard for today. Many earlier Mirages were retrofitted with that style exhaust. France's Army d'Air received its first 3E on January 1964. The 3E was exported to more countries than the sea. In 1967, Pakistan purchased 24 Mirage 3Es. With the purchase came 3 Mirage 3D two-seaters and 3R recon versions. Pakistan is the only country still flying Mirage 3s and will continue doing so until the JF-17 Thunder is completely operational. Before Dassault line ended in 1977, Pakistan acquired 10 more 3Rs. They would also acquire surplus 3Es from Australia and Lebanon. Much of these were the result of the F-16 embargo by the U.S. Mirage 3s have been upgraded with the Italian-made Grafito M3 radar and also used the PL-12 air-to-air missile built by China. The 3E was a success in Latin America also. The 3EA was built for the Argentine Air Force. 17 were completed by Dassault. Venezuela opted for 7 3EVs. These emitted the Doppler radar and the high-frequency antennas. They were eventually converted to a 50 EV standard. Brazil operated the 3EBR, all of which of Brazil's aircraft were completely built in-country using kits from Dassault. Eventually, all the airframes would be upgraded to the 3EBR-2. A major improvement was the addition of canards to prove maneuverability. Rounding out the countries were Lebanon, 10 of which were delivered, then sold to Pakistan. Spain, in 1976, ordered 16. And lastly, the South African Air Force supplemented its 3Cs with 17 Es. Two countries chose to build the aircraft under a license, Australia and Switzerland. The Mirage 3O was powered by an Avon Mark 67 turbojet built under license from Rolls-Royce. While one Mirage flew with the engine, it was decided to keep the ATAR engine. The Australian government decided that the government aircraft factory in Melbourne would produce the airframe. Yes, I can hear Grant and Steve cheering now. The biggest difference between the 3E and the 3EO was the avionics was sourced from local companies in Australia. CAC, or the Commonwealth Aircraft Company, was charged with producing the ATAR engine. Dassault produced 2 samples, with one being flown in France in 1963. GAF would then go on to produce 3 distinct versions for the RAAF. The Mirage 3OF, which was an interceptor, the 3OA, which was a ground attack aircraft, and the 2-seat lead-in trainer, the 3OD. Eventually, 48 Fs, 50 As, and 16 Ds were built. Eventually, the Fs were converted to A standards. The Royal Australian Air Force operated the aircraft, and eventually, all the Fs were converted. And in 1998, the Mirages were retired and 50 were sold to Pakistan. The other license-built Mirages are the 3S built by Switzerland. The Swiss bought a 3C to use as a developmental aircraft. The 36 Mirage 3Ss were designed from the ground up for additional survivability. The Swiss operate their aircraft from small fields and caves. Yes, caves. The Swiss took the Mirage 3 and made it a carrier-based aircraft. The fuselage and wings were reinforced so they could be lifted and moved by cranes and hung from ceilings. While not using catapults, reinforcements did allow for JETA or jet assisted takeoff. The nose cone is also removable, and the nose gear is lengthened for a higher angle attack for a shorter takeoff. The biggest difference internally would be the avionics. The Swiss chose U.S. electronics. The huge Terran 18 radar system supported the AIM-4 Falcon air-to-air missile. The missile was built under license by Saab as the RB-27. Also, radar warning receivers were added to the wingtips to support the Hughes radar system. The threes also brought back a supplemental rocket engine. The SEPR-841 motor doubles the Mirage's velocity and halves its time to climb to 60,000 feet. The tank could be used by small bursts for up to three times. When not installed, the supplemental fuel tank is put in place to act as ballast. In 1988, the fleet of 36 aircraft went through a total overhaul. The new Martin Baker 00 ejection seats were installed. The ANALE 40 chafe and flare dispensers were added, matching their F5E fleet. And also canards were added to the nose to improve maneuverability. One of the ground attack missions of the French Mirages was delivery of nuclear weapons. The Swiss kept the wiring for the nuclear attack delivery. Eventually, Switzerland decided not to develop a nuclear weapon, nor did they decide to purchase the weapons from France. The mission, though, would have been a one-way suicide strike. The Mirage couldn't reach Moscow but not return. It seems the more you study nuclear strategy, you realize the only way to win is not to play. Mirages were finally put out of service by the Swiss in 2003, and they were replaced by F-18CD Hornets, which were also license built. The last major variant of the Mirage is the 3R. The 3R is a single-seat reconnaissance aircraft based on the 3E. However, the aircraft retained the cannons, but the radar was stripped from the nose. In its place with the nose was up to five cameras. The avionics matched the 3C. 50 airframes were built for the Army d'Air, eventually supplemented by 3DRs. The suites of avionics were upgraded, Doppler navigation was added, as well as SLAR, or side-looking airborne radar. The nose was giving an infrared line scan camera. So with that, a total of 1,422 Mirages of all versions were built, and they would lead to the Mirage 550, which would see even more overseas success. So with that, I'll conclude our history segment on the Mirage 3, and next week we'll be doing the OV-10. So this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Thanks, David. It's not going to be another 8 weeks, right?
No, it'll be next week.
Okay.
As long as something doesn't come up, like major events or current events or people saying the F-35 was shocking that it was three different airplanes. You know, there's... We've had a lot of things that happened over the last 8 weeks.
We have. We certainly have.
Hey, and a quick question for you, David, there. Did I hear a quote from the movie War Games embedded in there?
No, possibly not. Why would you say that? How about a nice game of chess?
Exactly. Thank you, Joshua.
All right. Hey, we got a voicemail from Kyle Stewart. Now, he's a travel editor for upgrd.com, and he's got some interesting comments. So let's listen to Kyle.
Hi, Airplane Geeks. My name is Kyle Stewart. I'm a travel editor for upgrd.com, and we cover everything commercial and frequent flyers. I just wanted to address some things that came up in episode 400. I know I'm a few behind, but I took umbrage with some of the criticisms about U.S. carriers, and I think some of the facts might have been distorted a little bit. So one of the things I wanted to bring up was you mentioned that fares are down 19% since 2000, but I would argue that it's down even more than that. I'm not sure what data was used to pull that that information, but I know that in 2003, I booked an exceptionally good deal from Chicago to London for $403, and today that same fare is offered in the 300s by United and Delta. So I'm not sure that encompasses the total view. It's fairly routine this year so far to be able to book $300 or $400 round trips to Europe, $400 to $500 round trips from as far as New York City to Beijing, China. So it seems like it's down a lot more than 19% when you factor in inflation, though the U.S. market might be different. I also wanted to address the comfort of cabins. One of your guests was discussing how lavish these 1960s and 70s interiors were with sheepskin coverings, and of course that pales in comparison to what we now offer in business class, though. So, you know, back then first class was a little bit better service, but not a real differentiator in quality of product. But for the first time since the China Clipper, relatively every business class seat is lie flat, includes restaurant level meals and service, both on the ground and in the air. There are even closed door suites now. So I would argue that while the experience in extremely inexpensive economy seats has gone down, the experience in the front of the plane has significantly increased. I'd also argue that first class is now more attainable than ever. Upgrades are as cheap as $159 if you want to move to the front of the plane. And frequent flyers like myself and most of my readers loathe the fact that, you know, our status isn't rewarded because someone can simply check in and get an offer for a $99 first class seat, but that's the reality. So when you buy your $150 ticket from New York City to Las Vegas and then get an opportunity to upgrade to first class for $99, that is substantially lower than what you would have been able to do in the past. So you can now get a transcontinental service with JetBlue, which includes a private closed-door suite for as little as $399 each way. 5 years ago, people were paying $1,000 for a transcon round trip from New York City to Los Angeles or Fort Lauderdale to Los Angeles in coach. Now you can do that with full meal service and a lie-flat seat. Change fees are up, but fares are so cheap that it's hard to complain. Chicago and New York City has traditionally been a $400 round trip market. Now they're as low as $78 round trip. If you even factor in bags and charge change fees of $200, you still come out ahead. And Southwest is a great frequent flyer program. I'm a member, but for limited markets. They have no partners. They connect in airports where they don't have any other airlines to help out in case of irregular operations. And Southwest has also been found to be more expensive or the same price as the traditional carrier 60% of the time. So they're not a true low-cost carrier. So if I don't check bags and I rarely change my tickets, for me Southwest is less of a value unless I'm going someplace very specific. So I think that there is a broader picture that you guys missed a little bit. I appreciate the show. I just wanted to offer a take that maybe got missed.
Thanks to Kyle for that. I think it's pretty clear that airfares have decreased over the years. I guess there's different ways to measure that, but certainly the pricing structure has changed and the service levels have changed as well, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. We really appreciate the feedback from Kyle. These guys over at upgrd.com really have some more expertise than maybe than we do. And I think what we ought to do is get Kyle on the show and have a focused conversation with him. So we'll try to do that.
I want him to buy me some of these cheap tickets because I'm not seeing fares this low from the West Coast, but I'm also haven't been searching lately. But yeah, it sounds attractive. Let's get some cheap tickets.
And it never happens from PHL.
You're sure about that, huh? Because sometimes it's the skill of, you know, finding that cheap ticket.
So we need to learn some insights from the expert.
I think maybe. Well, we'll see. We'll see if we can get Kyle on the show and see if we can become more knowledgeable in that area. We heard from David, not our David, a different David. David writes to us and says, David's review reminded me of a book I'm currently reading that I can highly recommend. It's called Into the Black by Roland White. It's about the development of the space shuttle, culminating with STS-1 and the challenges of the flight. He says, I'm 90% through it and would highly recommend it. It's also a very easy read. So that's Into the Black by Roland White. Thanks to David for passing that along. Well, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. It's been a bit of a challenge, guys, with our connections. We've had to revert to some, maybe plan B, maybe plan C. Yeah, unorthodox approaches to it. But
good thing we've got those backup cans and strings, because if we hadn't had them tonight, we would have been in trouble.
That's right. Well, we're maybe in a little bit of trouble anyway. It's not our usual audio quality, so hopefully we'll return next time. We want to thank our guest, Patrick Smith. You can find his website at askthepilot.com. The book is Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. It's a fascinating read. Really, really recommend that. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes at airplanegeeks.com/410. You can find contact information and links to all of our social media presence at airplanegeeks.com. And we'd ask that you take a look at the show notes for links to the articles that we mentioned and some other supporting information. So let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, next week, they can find me at AirVenture for the whole week, tweeting as Jetwine, and who knows who we'll run into. We've chatted with quite a few folks on Twitter. We'll also be at the Pilot Proficiency Center at AirVenture for the afternoon segments every week. So in case you're interested in increasing your skill level in the cockpit, come on by and let's try some simulator flying with the great folks at Redbird and a few other great sponsors. And like I said, we'll look forward to telling you guys about AirVenture in 2 weeks.
Cool. All right. Have fun. Take lots of pictures, and we'll see you on the other side. All right, Max Trescott, where do folks find you?
Oh, you can find me at anything that has the words Max Wine in it. I couldn't resist. Now, the usual places, Max Trescott with a T on Twitter and Facebook, out at the Palo Alto Airport all the time. If you want to go flying, look me up there at SJ, short for San Jose, flight.com.
You know, maxwine.com is available. I just checked it. All right. David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
That's really sad because I was doing the same thing. you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on our listener team. And you can go to airplanegeeks.com/team to join our conversations there. And of course, you can find me on the UAV Digest with that Max Flight on Friday mornings.
All right. Very good. And you can find me in a couple of places, mostly LinkedIn here. The UAVDigest.com, as David mentions, the PaxXPodcast.com as well. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. Find more of his compositions at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening. Prescott?
Roger.
Mark?
Roger.
Max?
We lost Patrick.
Now we lost me.
Huh?
Oh, no, I'm still here.
Are you sure?
Oh, I hope you're recording that. That one's good.
You know, and that's the best part. I couldn't even make that stuff up, David. You know, I really couldn't.
No, you're right.
Yeah, it's me. It's Patrick.
Okay, good.
All right. Are we going to go with this?
Yeah, we're going to go with this. Let me bring the other guys in. There's David. There's Rob. There's Tristan.
I'm sorry. I should have gone to the Marriott, and we could have avoided all of
this. Okay.
All right. Rob's there.
I'll make up for the poor sound quality with my excessive elegance and compelling commentary.
Wonderful.
That's a lie.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you nobody, because they're not coming in.
David.
Yeah, I'm here,
okay.
I think.
All right.
You are?
3, 2, 1.
I'll tell you why it didn't work, because they were saying, Michelle said on the news on CNN and stuff, they were saying that Skype wasn't working at the convention. The system's overloaded.
Oh man, I never even thought of that.
That's what I said at the beginning. I was like, yeah, and guess what next Monday is?
The Democratic Convention?
Democrats. Really?